Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
From Wondery. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing all right, Justin. How are you?
I'm okay. Well, I'm better than okay. I'm doing really good, actually. So thanks for asking. I hope you're doing good too, Aaron.
Right. Well, you know, I'm trying to take it a little easy after our big trip to the UK.
Yeah. Maybe we'll do a Patreon episode or something where I can talk about my travel misadventures, but yeah. So Aaron, we both grew up during the 80s. I played D&D role-playing games, you know, we listened to crazy rock and roll and heavy metal. We watched violent movies and stuff. And on top of that, we watched ninja movies. We watched kung fu movies. Every Bruce Lee movie ever made, I probably have seen it three times. Every ninja movie back then in the 80s. I think one of my favorites, I'm sure it hasn't stood up, is Pray for Death. And what was the other one? American Ninja.
Pray for Death was a big one. I always thought it was one of the best ones, the best ninja movies.
Yeah, you had your Chuck Norris, your Gymkata.
Oh my.
Yeah, I'm pulling some crazy ones out. And I remember I was friends with tons of people that were into martial arts back then, specifically, you know, karate, kung fu, jeet kune do. And being that it was the 80s, there was also this kind of macho persona that would persist. And it was kind of a ridiculous thing where, you know, guys would be like, if I put my hands in my pocket, I could be arrested for concealing a deadly weapon, you know, stuff like that. Just over the top, ridiculous stuff. And it actually reminds me of like the Kenny Powers character from Eastbound and Down, or his other movie, Foot Fist Way. You know, it's this whole crazy persona that's out there. And I'm not saying all people that were into martial arts behave this way. I'm not. But you know that guy. He was in your dojo. He was in your class. You know, maybe he was the instructor. Who knows? But that guy existed in every town, and he would walk around like he was the top dog, like he could take on five guys at once, and, you know, just overly macho. And even as a kid, I always thought those guys were were ridiculous. And who would believe that? Who would believe that they're part of some ninja clan or, you know, their hands are registered as deadly weapons? I mean, it's just so dumb, right?
But you say that like everyone should know that.
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you that's not the truth. The truth is there are people that absolutely believe this, that believe that ninjas are real and they're deadly and they pose a threat.
Well, now with the UFC is being as popular as it is, I mean, we saw wrestlers and grapplers just take down strikers, you know, dominate for at least the large duration of the beginning of the UFC. And strikers didn't stand a chance because they didn't know what to do when they were on the ground. And I just remember seeing a guy walk into the octagon back in the day, and he was a ninjutsu expert, and just watching him get mauled, just completely mauled by either a kickboxer or a grappler. I don't remember now. Back then in the mid-90s, that's what really just clinched it for me. I was like, oh, ninjas were really cool to watch in movies, but in reality, it's just sort of this ridiculous concept, at least in the American version or the Western version of it.
Well, Justin, you know, you make fun of the ninja whose name was Steve Jenham. He won UFC 3. Now, of course, there's an asterisk with that because pretty much everyone else had been injured. So his road wasn't that tough. So then after that, when he got into, you know, 95 and on, that's when he was getting mauled. Mm-hmm. But for most people, they watch these movies and the ninjas in the ninja films or any of the Shokusugi films, they look deadly. They look scary. They look like the ultimate assassins.
They look badass.
Yeah. And they have the throwing stars and everything else. But here's the thing. You've got a guy that walks around like he owns the town and, like you said, thinks he can take on five opponents at once and kick all their butts or whatever. But there are people that absolutely buy into that. Because most of us, Justin, we're not trained. You know what I mean? And even those that are trained, not all of them can actually fight. So if you got a guy with that much confidence, well, he's already got an advantage.
He can be all bark and no bite. And I'm still going to back down from him because that confidence goes a long way. And I guess I just look at it all and I think I've seen people get accused and charged for crimes based on the fact that they listened to crazy violent music or that they played violent video games, that they were into role-playing as a kid. I didn't realize that that would reflect poorly on you if you were into martial arts. It just never occurred to me, and I guess that just shows how naive I am. So with that, what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight, we're talking about the murder of Scott Macklem, and the authorities very early on identified his killer. Now, Justin, you set this whole case up talking about martial artists and ninjutsu.
Yeah.
And the man who was accused in this case, well, he was apparently a ninja. He was a martial artist, right?
Yeah. Self-proclaimed, but he did train and he did know how to fight. Yeah.
But we're going to get into why you brought all that up. But I want to say from the outset that the way this man was killed had nothing to do with martial arts.
Nah, he was shot with a shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert for everybody. So I don't know how you tie martial arts in with that, but we're not the prosecutor.
Well, we'll do our best to explain why and how the prosecutor did this. But let's start at the beginning. Let's start with November 5th, 1986, because this is the day that Scott Macklem was murdered in Port Huron, Michigan.
On this morning, Scott is walking to his car. It's in the parking lot of a community college. And there are a lot of students out in this parking lot going to and from class. Just before 9 a.m., he was supposed to go to his gym class, but he had skipped because his class had started at like 8. And, you know, nobody makes it to their 8 a.m. class in college. That's just a rule. He's not at class, but he's in the parking lot at 8:55. And a gunshot rings out. It rips a hole through his jacket, goes in through his rib cage, hits his lungs, grazes his heart. He spins and falls to the ground. All the other students and people in the parking lot, they don't understand what's just happened. They don't understand that this was a shotgun blast. They thought fireworks. They thought a car had backfired. Nobody gets that somebody's just been shot. Some of the witnesses report that a car was slowly driving through the parking lot, and a couple of them looked at the car and saw a guy driving it, but they're not looking at it like, this guy just shot somebody and is driving away. They just remember seeing a car and someone driving at the same time as this gunshot, but they don't know it's a gunshot, not till a little bit later.
Some of the witnesses even saw a man lying on the ground, but because of the position that he was in, where he was kind of partly under the car he was next to, they almost wondered if he was working on the car. So they didn't really pay a lot of attention. They're just all looking around to see what's going on. And so, like you said, it takes a little bit of time. And then another student comes over, realizes this person has been shot, and attempts to perform CPR. This is all before emergency personnel get there. This is in, you know, what they call broad daylight during the morning. And so with all the students out, because it's during a class change, you would think we have a lot of witnesses. Someone must have seen something. But when you don't understand the context of the situation you're in, how much do you really see and understand at the time in order to relate later to the police? And that's the problem here.
And we know that eyewitness testimony really isn't the best. I've always sort of disbelieved that, but I did a class once where they were showing how eyewitness testimony is terrible. And so everyone's sitting in the class and the teacher's discussing how eyewitness testimony is bad. And then somebody comes into the class, walks up to the teacher's desk, steals the teacher's bag, and runs out into the hallway. And then the teacher's like, what just happened? And everyone's like, someone just came in and stole your bag. Describe what they look like. Aaron, I could not describe that person with a gun to my head. It was a man. I was terrible. I would have been the worst witness. So it's not that easy to recollect everything you saw, especially when you don't realize you should have been paying attention.
So the police arrive and there is some investigation going on. What they find is that most likely Scott was shot from between 6 and 10 feet away. That could have meant that someone was in a vehicle shooting at him. Also, they found a box, an empty ammo box, and a shotgun shell. These things would be retrieved, but they only test the box for fingerprints. They didn't test the shell. Now, Scott Macklem, his father was the mayor of a nearby town, and his family had some money. He had no criminal record, but you know how it is. If someone's kind of not a normal citizen, more of a named person, then they get a little extra attention, it seems, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, this is a mayor's son. This is somebody that they're going to look into because there might be a target on his head just for being who he is.
But also, status. That's what I'm getting at. He had some status. Now, he wasn't known to be the best student, though.
He skipped his gym class.
He was having trouble with his attendance and his grades. Now, that doesn't tell them why he was killed, but it's just something to note. So, what did they find when they talked to some witnesses who were present in that parking lot when Scott Macklem was shot, Justin?
A woman named Wanda Crow noticed a woman in a sweater walking near Scott's car at the time. That woman made no effort to help him. And she also saw someone sitting in a bright yellow car across from hers. Maybe that woman walking past Scott didn't realize he'd been shot. You know, no one was really paying that kind of attention. Another woman named Jean Anter saw a white male driving a tan or brown car through the parking lot. She says that he was driving very fast. She saw Scott crouched over next to his car he said, help me, I'm hurt. Gene walked to class, but saw a blonde woman getting into a car parked on the opposite side of the curb from Scott's car.
Yeah, I want to talk about this real quick because knowing that Scott was shot with such a weapon, with a shotgun, the question would be, how long would he live after getting shot where he did? And the idea is he would have been dead within a couple minutes. So is it possible that he got like shot already and then he was still able to partially stand? I find this a little weird, don't you?
Yeah, and the fact that his lung was punctured, I'm thinking, could he have enunciated, help me, or would have you just been wailing in pain? I don't know.
But it's weird because Gene just walks to class. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's just interesting when people give their accounts of what they've seen, and maybe we're not getting all of the information here, but it's just odd that she would just walk onto class without trying to help this person or at least alert someone else to get help.
Yeah. Another witness, Kathleen Ballard, heard the gunshot, saw a small car pulling out of a parking spot next to Scott's car. The driver was white with dark hair. Now, I saw a photo of Scott's body, and it appeared that there was a car there. He was by his car, and there was another car parked, and he was laying in between the two. So I'm looking at this and thinking, she saw a car pull out from that spot. I'm like, well, was it the spot right next to his car where he fell or the spot on the other side? It's not clear. I don't know if it means anything. Renee Gobin saw a white man driving a car with a ski mask folded up over his forehead, and he wrote down the license plate. Now, this is Michigan. So ski mask folded up over the head. I don't know. I don't know how cold it was that day.
And this is the thing, multiple people report seeing sort of a brown car driving away, and most people report that it wasn't driving fast or anything. It was just sort of casually driving through the parking lot.
Yeah, it was only Gene that said it was driving fast, but I think anyone going over 5 miles per hour in a parking lot's too fast, so everyone has their own interpretation of it.
So, of course, the police are going through and interviewing more people. They get to Scott's family because they're gathered at the hospital. At 12 p.m., they spoke to Crystal Merrill and her younger sister. Crystal was Scott Macklem's girlfriend. Now, these two both said they thought John Lamar could have been the killer. And Crystal told them that John was very dangerous, that he kept poison darts in his shoes, and that he had a bunch of weapons at his home. Now, here's the part. This is a call back to earlier. She described John Lamar as heavy into ninja.
Well, I now have the name for my new heavy metal band.
And that he had threatened to kill her and her family if she ever told anyone about his lifestyle.
So they have a suspect. They have a lead. She's saying that this John guy is dangerous, has threatened her, and keeps weapons around. So investigators are going to follow this lead because they kind of have nothing else to go on.
That's right. You know, this is typical of what we call a drive-by shooting. So they have to look at the victim and then go from there because maybe they'll find someone who had it out for them. But luckily, these police officers, they get a great tip from Crystal and her sister. They get directions to Lamar's home. But of course, they end up finding out this isn't John Lamar. John Lamar was just an alias. His real name is Frederick Freeman, and he was renting a house. So his landlord told the police that her tenant started renting the place from her on April 17th of 1986. And she knew that he was an engineer who did computer work. Now, they started talking to other neighbors, and they were saying, we've seen him practicing martial arts in the front yard. And they'd also heard him fighting with his girlfriend, and they kind of wondered if he was abusive towards her. They eventually learned that Frederick Freeman was possibly wanted in Washington State for another crime. So what they do is they keep looking for Frederick, Freddie, as we might call him, in Rock, Michigan. And as of November 8th, they started surveilling the place, but they were having trouble finding him.
I don't want to say that they were having trouble finding him because he was on the run, or if they just didn't know his regular go-to places. And since he wasn't at his primary residence, they didn't know where to start.
And as we go on, it's helpful to know that people have described Freddie Freeman as a drifter. So despite him having what might be a residence, it doesn't mean he would actually be there. He could have been at a girlfriend's house. So it's on November 9th that he's driving to Detroit. And it's, Justin, how do you describe this? I mean, he ends up going through multiple states, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and he's calling his girlfriend Michelle along the way from payphones. And there's an attorney from Escanaba, which is in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, who lets Freddie know that he's wanted for murder. And so Freddie is figuring that this murder victim is one of his childhood friends that he'd had a falling out with, because he's thinking, what could possibly happen where I'm wanted? This is just in his head. Like, he's thinking, oh, it must be someone I used to know. So he calls the Flint Police Department, because that's what the attorney told him was, the police in Flint are looking for you. And he called them and said, what do I have to do? Because I don't want to be wanted. I want to clear this up as soon as possible. And so he offers that he'd been in the Upper Peninsula for the past several weeks, so he couldn't have been in Flint. But the police department, they're telling him, we are not looking for you, so stop bothering us, essentially.
I mean, he was offering to turn himself in so he could clear it all up. I mean, he's on the road driving to Detroit, and he's offering to come back and turn himself in. Now, I don't want to come off biased from the get-go, but if I had murdered somebody and I'm driving from state to state, and then I'm informed that I'm wanted and I've actually done it, I might just keep driving.
November 10th, 1986, state troopers visit the house in Rock, Michigan, and Michelle, Freddie's girlfriend, says he'll be back later. So it's this weird situation where Freddie's kind of on the move. And, you know, you could look at it this way. I think he called the police station because he wanted to know what they knew and figure out whether he was really in trouble. But since they didn't give him any information, I think he became even more concerned and didn't know what was happening, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a confusing situation. So if he had done this, he's fishing for information. If he hasn't done this, then he's just trying to get it all straightened out.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So it's November 11th when he arrives in Detroit and gets to a friend's home. On November 12th and 13th, the Port Huron Police Department had gotten a warrant to search his house and then a warrant to arrest him. So Michelle gets a call from Freddie on the 13th, and she says, "Hey, the Port Huron police were here. They're looking for you. They want to arrest you." And so he asked her, "Can I speak to an officer?" And, well, she gets an officer on the line. Detective John Bounds tells Freddie that Scott Macklem was the one who was murdered. Now, Freddie says, "I don't really know anything about Scott." And he goes, "I know Crystal because he used to rent videos from the store she worked at. And he knew that she had dated Scott, but said he hadn't spoken to her since July and moved to Rock soon thereafter."
Police will end up getting a SWAT team to raid Michelle's home. This is a pretty intense situation. And they surrounded the house. She's not allowed to put on her coat or shoes or anything. They arrest her and they walk her down the driveway with her hands up. They took her into custody. She said that she was with Freddie at the exact same time that Scott was murdered, which this is how many miles away from the scene of the crime?
It's about 400 miles away.
So given this is the girlfriend of the accused, she could be lying to cover for him, and the police will tell her, "You're lying. We know that he was there, and we know that he's the one that shot Scott." They go on to threaten to take her child away if she testifies in his defense. She was 7 months pregnant with his baby. She asked to see their warrant, and Detective Bounds pulls it out, but what was written on the warrant was that they were looking for Frederick Freeman, and there was no specific items or anything on that search warrant. And this is always a point of contention with any search warrant, is you get a judge to sign off on it, and they have to say, you know, this guy's accused of shooting somebody, so therefore we're going to be looking for weapons, we're going to be looking for guns, ammo, whatever. You have to specify exactly what you're looking for. They don't do any of that. But the SWAT team, they trash the house. They slash open all the pillows. Everything's just on the floor. It looks like a bomb went off.
During that time, they also seized her dogs and took them to a shelter. And this is a sad thing. By the time she gets back home and sees the destruction, she will also find out that her dogs had been euthanized. And I don't know about you, Justin, but I got the feeling that when they did this, it was a show of force. Not only was it, "You better come clean, but you're going to have to come clean because your guy is responsible for a murder, and we will not stop until he is put away."
Now, that night, Freddie will call his ex-girlfriend, Crystal. I say girlfriend or ex-girlfriend loosely because they weren't really a thing for very long. He calls her from a payphone in Troy, Michigan. They spoke for about 2 hours while the police were listening in, because they had tapped all the phones of everyone that Freddie knew. He says he didn't kill Scott. He didn't even own a gun. And he has a lot of witnesses that can prove his alibi. Crystal said that she told the police about his martial arts training and all the weapons he owned. She made implications that he was in the mafia and that he had threatened Scott. Freddie said that the police should be looking at someone who Scott had angered and not him. So Crystal's painting this really bad picture of Freddie, saying he's hot-headed, very quick to anger, and really into martial arts and has this arsenal of weapons. But when she's referring to weapons, she's talking about like samurai swords and nunchucks and stuff like that, not guns.
The reason why they talked so long was because Crystal was keeping him on the line. The police were tracing the call. So by the time Freddie was hanging up, the police were on top of him. Now, it's interesting because Freeman attempted to get them a polygraph test, right?
Oh, yeah. They actually scheduled it and everything, apparently.
But then he didn't get to take it.
Nah, they canceled it the day he was scheduled.
You know, it's not surprising because that's the kind of tool where if someone says they don't really want to take it, then maybe they really want to administer it. But if you have the person going, oh, no, please give it to me. Not much value in it at that point, is there?
But these investigators, they're going to put more weight on other things.
So they have the killer in custody so they can proceed with a trial. This is April 29th, 1987, and the prosecutor, Robert Cleland, tells the jury that the motive to kill Scott Macklem was so that Freddie could control Crystal. In this prosecutor's words, Freddie wanted to make Crystal his property, his handmaiden, virtually his slave. They go on to call him a ninja killer who regularly practiced martial arts and was a cunning ninja. Now, again, Scott was killed with a shotgun, and yet they're starting off this trial describing Frederick Freeman as a ninja killer.
If you don't know anything about ninjas, well, normally they're wearing all black and they're sneaking around unseen and they're going to use a silent weapon, mostly a bladed weapon, to assassinate their target. Not a shotgun in the middle of a parking lot at 8:55 in the morning while school's in session. But, you know, hey, we got a ninja killer here.
One of their big witnesses for the prosecution was Crystal Merrill. She described her relationship with Freddie as like living in hell. She claimed that he physically abused her, raped her, and psychologically abused her, and that he claimed he was high up in the Yakuza and wanted to make her part of that organization. And he also threatened to put a contract on Scott Macklem after Scott called the store while he was there, and she lied about who was on the phone. So he said, if you don't stop lying, I'm going to kill you. And if Scott didn't leave her alone, he'd take care of him. She claims that he put listening devices around her family's farm to spy on her. So Justin, I know we've said this many times, but say again what can happen in a courtroom.
Oh, this is my go-to saying is the prosecutor can allege anything. The prosecutor can say that you flew in on a pig with an AK-47 and killed everyone in the room and flew away on that same pig. And if that doesn't get objected to, if that doesn't get shot down in a court of law, it goes in. And a jury has to make a judgment based on you on a flying pig with an AK-47. Or in this case, you in a parking lot with a shotgun. Now, somebody could say, Justin, come on, man. A flying pig, you have to prove that pigs fly. You have to prove that you had enough training to fly a pig. And you have to prove that you owned a shotgun and used the shotgun and whatever. But as we get more into this case, you'll understand that it is a valid comparison.
And they can show the jury anything they want. And if it's not objected to, it's truth. In this case, they had a slew of weapons that they were showing the jury, and none of them were owned by Frederick Freeman.
You would think that they have raided all of his places that he resides at. They would have actually found some ninja-ish like weapons, some swords, something to present to the jury. Maybe they did, but it wasn't, intimidating enough. So instead, they just go to some martial arts place and say, give us your biggest, baddest knives and swords and nunchucks and all your exotic weaponry, and we're going to show that to a jury. And at that point, you might as well have shown the jury a rocket launcher that wasn't used in the crime. But this isn't objected to. This isn't fought against. So the jury has all of this information now.
Three of the people who were at the parking lot that morning when Scott Macklem was shot were brought in as witnesses. So one of the witnesses, Renee, identified him in a photo and an in-person lineup. Now, according to Renee, he heard a gunshot and then saw a man driving away from the scene. He said the man's face was partially hidden. Renee was hypnotized so that he could identify the person he saw. And lo and behold, he identified Frederick Freeman.
And real quick, that photo lineup, Frederick was put in front of like a black and white wall. It looked like a very institutional wall. And everyone else in the photo lineup was photoed in front of another wall.
Wasn't he facing a different direction too?
Yeah. So Frederick was the only one that stood out.
Yeah, this photo lineup will factor very largely later on.
It's just better to have a photo lineup of a bunch of people that look somewhat similar in all of the same backgrounds or all different backgrounds, something to that effect. But when this is the photo lineup, I have to say, Aaron, it looks like they were trying to get somebody to point his photo out. It's just human nature to look for what's wrong with this picture, which photo stands out, which person stands out. And it was his.
They might as well have taken a pink Sharpie and circled his picture.
That's a good way to put it.
Because if you just look at the actual men in these photos, I can see why they were chosen. Okay. That part was fair. It's everything else that was not fair.
Yeah.
So then, you know, the other two witnesses they called from the scene both identified Frederick Freeman. Now, the prosecution has a statement from a jailhouse informant, aka a jailhouse snitch named Philip Joplin.
Yeah. Philip's a con man. He is being charged with fraudulent checks and just a whole litany of things. And Phillips claims that Frederick has confessed it all to him. And in his confession, he says he used a shotgun and Scott yelled and screamed for his life. Now, Aaron, the morning of, people said they heard a boom. One witness said she thought she heard Scott saying, "Help me." Nobody reported a man screaming for his life. Nobody reported a man screaming in general. So this Joplin, this jailhouse snitch, wow. I mean, maybe he's just regurgitating what Frederick told him, but it doesn't match up with the reality of the situation. One more thing about jailhouse snitches is whenever a jailhouse snitch gets on the stand and testifies against somebody, it's common practice to ask them, "What did you get in return for this testimony? Did you get a lesser sentence? Did you get charges dropped?" And Joplin says no. Prosecutor says he has not been given anything. The judge even says, no, he wasn't given anything.
So the defense has their work cut out for him. But supposedly they have this great alibi in their back pocket. So they start strong. They say there is no physical evidence connecting Frederick Freeman to the murder of Scott Macklem.
Yeah, no fingerprints on that shotgun ammo box.
No fingerprints connect him. There's no proof that he owned a shotgun. You know, they can't even prove that he was in the area. He was 400 miles away, and we have witnesses to that effect. And so they give a timeline. They say on November 5th, 1986, he got home sometime after 2 in the morning. His car had broken down.
At the local Ponderosa.
And at 9 a.m., he and his girlfriend Michelle were still in bed, and later that morning, they drove into Escanaba, and at noon, they were at Cho's Black Belt Academy, and they talked to people there. In fact, Frederick and the martial arts instructor there were talking about how it was amazing that Chuck Norris could pull off the moves he did while wearing blue jeans. You know, back then, they didn't have blue jeans that flexed like they do nowadays.
In fact, they were questioning if it was actually possible or if it was just movie magic.
Well, anybody that's seen Chuck Norris movies, man, he just made it happen. But yeah, so they went to different places in Escanaba, including a Kmart where his car again broke down, and he purchased a part to fix it, a fuel pump.
So not only have we established that he's hundreds of miles away at the exact same time as the murder, but that his car is broken down, so he's not driving it across the state. Also, his car is broken down. He doesn't have a lot of money. he can barely keep his car running. So if he doesn't have a lot of money, can he afford a shotgun? Can he afford to travel across the state? Just things to keep in mind.
So this crime happened November 5th. Well, we have these different witnesses who state when they spoke with Freddie, when they met with him. So the times are very difficult because, let's just say, for the killer to go from Port Huron back up to Escanaba, if that was the case, it would take 6.5-7 hours at best.
Yeah.
So whoever did this, that seems impossible, especially with a car that doesn't really run that well anyway. That's a big ask on that car.
And apparently they had intimidated his girlfriend, Michelle, so much between the SWAT raids, threatening to take her child away, that she didn't testify at this trial.
She never even was asked to testify.
I mean, that's pretty insane because he had over 20 people that knew where he was that morning and throughout the day. So in all the alibis I've ever heard, this is the most solid alibi ever. This is the most airtight alibi I think I've ever come across, besides somebody was in jail at the time of the murder. There's only a couple people that place him at the scene of the crime, and these are eyewitness accounts of a man driving away in a car when they don't even know that a shooting has happened. I'm going to take 20 people at the top of the state who are engaged in conversation about Chuck Norris with him over a few random people in a parking lot who didn't get a good look.
The defense attorney, David Dean, also brought forth a statement from Booker Brown. He was the third person in the cell with Frederick Freeman and Philip Joplin. Brown said that Freeman had been telling them about his innocence and that Joplin was just outright lying.
So jailhouse snitch is saying Freeman did it. Other cellmate saying that didn't happen. And that other cellmate really isn't getting anything for his testimony because, sorry, a defense attorney can't grant you anything for your testimony when you're incarcerated. Prosecutor, on the other hand, definitely can.
But he didn't, supposedly, right?
Yeah. There's a little loophole that prosecutors can use, and you can tell an inmate, a jailhouse snitch, whatever, hey, if you do this for me after the trial, we can have a talk about your charges, about your sentence. And that's the loophole right there.
An offer of help is better than no help at all.
Yeah.
So the prosecution, their whole thing is, it doesn't matter what they say about his alibi because no one saw him between 1:30 in the morning and 12 p.m. later that day. The only person who says anything is someone who's not here to talk. Michelle's not there, so there is no one that can account for Frederick Freeman's whereabouts for that entire time. That's, what is that, 10 and a half hours?
Yeah, that's plenty of time to, I guess, at least get down there, perpetrate the crime, and then, but not quite enough time to get back from, you know, 9 a.m. to noon. That's not enough time, but they have some theories on that too, right?
Yes, it's during this closing argument where the prosecutor says Freeman could have chartered a plane and flown to Port Huron and then flown back to Escanaba between 1:30 a.m. and 12 p.m. on November 5th. Because according to him, private pilots sometimes hang around airports to wait for customers. Now, I actually know someone personally who was flying planes, small private planes like this, back in the 80s. And he told me that is absolutely true. And sometimes they could even be got for, you know, cheap if they just felt like flying.
Yeah, if they paid for the gas. But gas prices, even in the 80s, for a plane, not that cheap. But if you're going to make a claim that your accused has chartered a plane, flown hundreds of miles to commit this crime, and then flown back, well, you have to show, what airport did he fly out of? What pilot? What aircraft? There are logs of everything that's coming in and out of an airport. I don't care if it's the 80s. You have to get clearance to take off and you have to get clearance to land. So if you're not producing that, then you have to assume that this person has totally gone under the radar, found a pilot who's going to take off from somebody's farm, fly across the state, illegally land somewhere that's there's no airport, then have access to a car to drive to this college campus, know exactly where Scott's going to be, and shoot him with a shotgun, drive back to that rogue airstrip, and then this pilot's going to fly you back. A guy who is a starving martial artist who can't even keep his car running and who at this point has been completely character assassinated by an ex-girlfriend and a jailhouse snitch. But all of the evidence shows that he actually was hundreds of miles away with no access to travel that far, no opportunity to travel, and essentially had no motive because his current girlfriend and all of his other girlfriends said, no, I mean, he was kind of a macho dude and whatnot, but he had no interest in controlling me. And Michelle even goes on to say that the ex Crystal would sometimes call and harass him, but they hadn't spoken in months prior to this shooting.
I don't really want to leave it there, Justin, because I would like to argue that it's possible that no log was kept of this flight. But what I would say to you is, what's the likelihood, again, of a guy with no money being able to charter a plane and get this done in such a short amount of time? Because I don't care that they can't account for him at 1:30 in the morning. This man, Scott Macklem, was shot before 9 a.m. So given that he has to fly out there, he still has to fly back in time to go into town and meet all these people and do all of that stuff. So my problem with this is just an accusation. This is just, it's possible.
If you say he flew across the state on a flying pig and shot a man with a shotgun and then flew back on that flying pig, you have to prove it. And the defense sure as hell should be objecting to it, but they didn't. And it was in a closing argument, so that's a little iffy how much that objection can go.
But just so people understand, the prosecution makes it seem like Frederick Freeman knew all about Scott, knew where he would be, and was able to somehow charter a plane with getting a car ride to each airport and back, and do this within about a couple hours' time that morning. Okay? Now, since it's the closing argument, that's what the jury's left with. So just to be fair to the jury, when they were first asked, like, who do you think did this? They were not in agreement. But by the time they took their final vote, they were all in agreement. And I have no doubt it's because when it came down to it, it didn't matter how good the alibi was. The prosecution kept saying how dangerous Frederick Freeman was, that he was a ninja killer, and that he was very upset about Crystal speaking with Scott Macklem. And because he couldn't control her, he took his rage out on the object of her affection.
Yeah. And he had all these connections and ties to secret ninja societies and whatnot that could have gotten him access to all of these things to commit this murder.
This is literally an 80s movie come to life. You can go back and watch some of these movies. Watch Pray for Death. I have no idea what it's like these days because I haven't watched it since I was a kid. But this is the state of mind of the prosecution here. They really believe this was possible. Only again, this man, Scott Macklem, was killed with a shotgun. He wasn't killed with a katana sword or something.
I would say this was the dumbest jury on the face of the planet, but they have to go with what's presented in a trial. They have to go with that. And the information they were given really was one-sided. The jury's trying to figure this out, and this looks like a targeted attack. Scott was the intended target. So if it wasn't Frederick, then who was it? And if you don't give a jury any other options, then what are they to do? I mean, the judge can sit there and overturn a guilty verdict if they want. They can, but judge is thinking, well, this guy looks a little shifty. He might be a dangerous ninja warrior.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
What's the jury supposed to do? Are they supposed to release the most dangerous person who had ever entered St. Clair County?
Yeah.
Those are the words of the prosecutor. So their decision comes down. This is in May of 1987. Their decision comes down and they find Frederick Freeman guilty of murder. And on August 3rd of that year, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. We'd already said that the episode is obviously titled Temujin Kensu, but we were going to talk about Frederick Freeman. Well, after he went into prison, Freeman changed his name to Temujin Kensu because of his Buddhist faith. Now, it's a little bit more complicated than that because he changed later from Buddhism to, I guess it's Kotal religion. He created his own religion, essentially. And this is where a lot of people might focus and say, it sounds like he's trying to start a cult or something, this and that. But I don't really think it's that important. That where he gets his name, Temujin Kensu, is that Temujin was Genghis Khan's original name. So that's another thing that people might look at and question. The important thing to take away, though, is that once you're convicted, obviously you want to appeal, you want to get things overturned. Temujin, well, his attorney, David Dean, where do we start with him, Justin? Because he literally dropped the ball throughout the whole trial. All he was able to do was produce that document explaining how Joplin was lying, and he was able to express Frederick Freeman's, now Temujin Kensu's, alibi. That's it, okay? He didn't raise objections where he should have. He didn't fight for his client. And the background of Dean is he used to be the prosecutor in that area, and he was also known for substance abuse and using cocaine. Now, I personally find this important because if you're not defending your client well enough and you have all these problems on the side, I think that's a problem. I don't feel comfortable knowing what I know about the case and knowing that moving forward as though he had a trial, it's over. I don't feel comfortable with that. How do you feel about it?
It's ineffective counsel. That's what it is. And I know it's hard to prove that, and I know everyone that's found guilty, that's their number one appeal or reason why they appeal, but this guy was extremely ineffective and had known substance abuses that he told Frederick about. He wasn't able to counter the ex-girlfriend in an effective manner. What happens with Joplin is Joplin recants what he said about Frederick's confession. Also, Joplin did get a lesser sentence, which means the prosecutor was lying and the judge was actually in on it because they both knew the truth. But since it wasn't agreed upon before his testimony, he gets a pass. Personally, Aaron, I think the prosecutor should have been disbarred and the judge should have been removed from the bench. But, you know, the system can do whatever it wants when they find its own loopholes, because then it's illegal to do it.
Well, and the other thing about David Dean, the defense attorney, was he has this whole history with all of these people, meaning the detective with the judge. I mean, just in 1982, he represented the lead detective, John Bounds, because he was fired for misconduct. there was a lawsuit against the city. So they had a connection before he ever met Frederick Freeman.
That's a conflict of interest.
You would think. I don't understand. It's like there's this good old boy club going on there, and then someone's accused of murder, and then they give him one of the good old boys to represent him. But how is that guy supposed to really battle against the people that he's worked with all those years?
Yeah.
I'm sure someone's going to say, if I was at trial and I was faced off against, you know, people I respected and worked with for years, I could do it because I believe in the system. Good for you. I admire that. I truly do. Do I believe that happened in this case? No, I do not.
Not even close.
So here's the important thing, though. Because in the spring of 1995, Bill Proctor, he was an investigative reporter out of Detroit, started working on a series about this case. He's the one who got Philip Joplin to recant his testimony. Now, if you read through the appeals, and I read through them, they make a big deal out of how Joplin never really did recant. It was just an attorney who spoke about how he basically recanted, etc. They try to separate it out. This reporter did the hard work. We know that Philip Joplin recanted, okay?
I just watched a YouTube video watching him recant on video. So yeah, I know he recanted.
Yeah, I mean, Joplin explained it. He said, I tried to back out of testifying, but the assistant prosecutor exploded. He said, it's too late. You can't back out. Now, he said he also wrote a letter to try and get a deal. This man, Joplin, died in 1998. But before he died, he signed the affidavit. And you'll see this covered in the appeal. But he signed this affidavit talking about how the prosecutor offered him special treatment in exchange for testimony. Again, it's the you scratch our back and then later we'll scratch yours. We'll see how that works out.
And we don't have to report it during the trial. We're going to do it afterwards.
Yeah. They know what they're doing. They're not being foolish about this. They know exactly what they're doing. So Bill Proctor, again, is doing this whole series. He's the one that did all the hard work on this. You know, he watched. Temujin took a polygraph test. He passed it, right? Now, of course, we can say whatever we want about that, but Temujin had wanted to take one from the beginning. Now, Michelle, who had not been called to testify at the trial, she's telling her story again in 1999. She took a polygraph. She passed. And she told the media, I know he is innocent. I was there. I will say it until I die. And at that point, they weren't together. This is an ex-girlfriend of Temujin's. You know, there's a lot we could talk about here. But what I want to get into, Justin, is Temujin was trying to appeal this case based on what he could use to get out. Okay. What that means is he can't go and argue, look, I had an alibi. There was this, there was that. He can't do that. The only thing he can focus on was basically that he had ineffective counsel. And here's the primary part, that the photographic lineup that people were looking at was prejudicial. It was steered towards picking Frederick Freeman. That's the whole gist of this appeal of his fight to get free. And I can see why the courts don't give a crap.
Honestly, Aaron, if somebody's appealing on the photo lineup was flawed, I don't know if that raises to the level of you deserve a retrial or an appeal granted. His alibi should, but as most people might not know how our system works, if it got shot down during your trial, you don't get to appeal on it. If you had DNA that proved you were innocent and it was deemed inadmissible or the prosecutor just had a better argument, you can't fall back on that DNA evidence anymore. You can't use it during an appeal. And this is what's happened to Temujin, is all he has is that photo lineup.
So in 2007, Temujin Kensu filed a writ of habeas corpus. This is him challenging the constitutionality of his detention. And a federal judge, Denise Hood, granted his request because she agreed that he had ineffective assistance of counsel because Michelle was never called to the stand, right? Remember, they said he has no real alibi because no one can account for his whereabouts from 1:30 a.m. to 12 p.m. on November 5th, 1986. And because Michelle wasn't called, that's why they could get away with that. But when this judge, Denise Hood, was looking at it, she said, no, that's right. So she ordered a retrial. But as is often the case, a higher court took a look at this and said, that's cute, but no. If you read that decision, it reads like they sort of understood why she made her decision, but they just didn't feel it was important enough. They didn't think that her testimony would have meant much in the end. All I can say is, you know, we've covered a lot of cases on this show, and there aren't too many that mimic this case in regards to a seemingly solid alibi, meaning nothing when it comes to court, because literally everyone that surrounded Temujin, or at the time, Frederick Freeman, you know, they were pretty much all aligned against him. And I don't know how you can argue against that.
But he had people from his, I don't know, dojo. He had all kinds of people that knew him, people that didn't know him, all vouching for his location that day. People that have no interest in him as a person saying, no, he was in my town at the time. And that's very telling. And that, to me, holds a lot more weight than some random eyewitness who's watching a car driving away. It just doesn't gel for me. And not only does he have eyewitnesses, but he made purchases. He has the receipts. He wasn't there. But I think this comes down to people don't have someone else to point the finger at. So did the husband do it? Did the ex-boyfriend do it? Well, probably, because who would have done it?
And over all that time, we're talking decades now, Crystal Merrill has never wavered. She's still 100% positive that Frederick Freeman killed Scott Macklem. So now we go forward. Temujin's new attorney these days is Imran Syed, who is assistant director of the Michigan Innocence Clinic. And, you know, Temujin has a last chance here because the state of Michigan has the Conviction Integrity Unit, which was formed in 2019 by Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel. Now, of course, they have many cases that have been forwarded to them involving DNA and forensic testing to make sure that these convictions are solid. And if they're not, then they can do something about it. So the CIU submitted his clemency application in May of 2020. And they stated, and this is significant, they stated that Temujin Kensu should be freed based on the lack of evidence and humanitarian grounds. Well, he was diagnosed with COVID. He was also diagnosed with a brain tumor, chronic lung disease, and congestive heart failure while in prison. So because he has all these conditions and COVID back in 2020, this is kind of a scary situation for him. Now, the governor of Michigan is Gretchen Whitmer. She has denied Temujin Kensu clemency as of January 4th, 2021. Now, she said she spoke with the Michigan Parole Board, and, well, because of them, he's been denied clemency four times. This has been in 1990, 1995, 2004, and 2021. And that's because this parole board in Michigan absolutely opposes Temujin Kensu's release.
Well, you have to admit guilt and show you have remorse and show you're trying to become a better person. Now, he's not going to do that because he didn't do it.
Now, here's the question, Justin. Do we want to get into a possible...
Yes. So this defense attorney, you said, had some ties to other members of the court. Also, he had some substance abuse issues. And then Scott's father was a mayor. He had some ties to people. And they all have ties to the upper echelon of society and the lower echelon of society. So I'm not really into conspiracies. I'm not really into this was a cover-up that went all the way to the top. But if I'm going to believe that Temujin chartered a plane and flew across the state and got back in time for karate practice, well, then, you know, maybe I'm going to be a little bit more open to these other ideas of a complete cover-up and conspiracy to frame this man. Because if I'm willing to suspend disbelief that he could have gotten a plane, well, this other idea isn't that far-fetched.
No, it's kind of a basic idea, because the idea here, and this is just alleged, we're not saying it's true, but allegedly, Scott Macklem was a drug dealer. And this is how you figure David Dean into it and some other characters. But Bill Proctor looked into this and he contacted Sam Gunn, who was an attorney. Sam had a client we'll call Jim. He was an enforcer for organized crime in the Port Huron area. This enforcer says he was ordered to kill a low-level drug dealer named Scott Macklem. So the story is, on November 4th, Jim and Scott packaged some cocaine together. Jim refused to kill Scott himself, but called someone and told them where Scott would be on November 5th. According to Jim, Port Huron Police Department was involved with the crime organization. Now, again, this is all alleged, and I wouldn't pretend to say that it was absolutely true. But like you're saying, if we can allege that, or actually convict someone for chartering a private plane to go kill the boyfriend of an ex-girlfriend when he had many girlfriends, and then fly back and try to create a fake alibi or whatever, then why can't we just assume that maybe there was a hit on a drug dealer? It's not that far-fetched. So I would say it's a theory we can think on.
And you can go way down that rabbit hole and find connections to his father, find connections to other people in low places. It's not as far-fetched as somebody chartering a plane and flying across the state with zero evidence or any kind of paper trail of that.
So what I would say is there's a lot of content out there. If you want to learn more about this case, head out to YouTube. Also, if you feel so inclined, because we get these questions, don't we, Justin? How can I help? How can I do something? If you want to, you should contact Dana Nessel or Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
Tell them what you think.
Yeah, because that's the only way something might happen. There needs to be maybe a push here, because when it comes down to it, this is a guy who they have zero evidence against. It's literally people saying he did it. That's it. They have no proof of anything they've alleged. But again, if you say it in a court of law and it's not challenged, courts afterward, when it comes to appeals, will just say, what are you complaining about? You had your day in court. That was already handled. Why do we have to bother with it? That's not what we do here. That's how our system works. And yeah, we have to say it every time because it's so unbelievable, but it's true.
You know, people always just think that we're very anti-law enforcement, anti-system. And it's not that I'm even anti those things. I just want people to know this is the reality of it. This is how the system works. And maybe we should change it if we don't like the way things are run.
Well, Justin, before we go, I wanted to say a big thank you to our listeners and ask you for a favor. If you are enjoying the show, please leave us a review on whichever platform you listen to us on. That could be Apple Podcasts, it could be Stitcher, it could be CastBox, what have you. Just leave us a review to let other people know to check out the Generation Y podcast.
Give us a follow on social media, whether it be Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, whatever. And if you do go out to podcast groups that people recommend episodes or whatnot on, hey, give us a recommendation. Tell other people to check us out and give them an episode to listen to.
And if you want to know more about Justin or I, or maybe our pets, especially visit our TikTok at Gen Y Pod, because we're putting out content regularly there. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.